associate myself with the remarks of Regent Lansing. I agree with her articulation of this issue. I believe that there are indeed ugly and terrible acts that take place in the name of pseudoscience. We saw it in the Axis powers during World War II. We saw some of the ugly pseudoscience that took place relative to the justification of the race justification of slavery in America. We saw some pseudoscience relative to the chronology, shape of one's head, relative to intelligence. There's a line of perhaps research that isn't research, and I think we'll know it when we see it. None of us, I think, would embrace tobacco. Some of us are former smokers, to our regret. This activity is yet legal in America. I'm prepared to say that our scholars ought to be put in a position to make the judgment. And until they make wrong judgments, I'm prepared to let them continue to do so. Thank you.
Thank you. Not going to wrap it up, but... Thank you, Chair Gould. I think it's fair to say that faculty are heavily engaged and invested, along with the president and the provost, and most, perhaps all, of the members of the board in achieving a constructive outcome on this issue, so that we can refocus our time and attention on the many challenges facing the UC, where the faculty want to work with the regent and the president to make the excellent institution I referred to earlier even more excellent and enduring in that excellence. I want to be very careful not to impede rather than promote the chance in due course of arriving at what would frankly be a compromise that would accommodate the earnest concerns of members of this board who wish to attenuate the university's association, real or imagined, with the activities of the tobacco companies. In the view of faculty members, who, to a degree, I think many members of this board fail almost utterly to appreciate, have felt unfairly abused and questioned in their integrity for reasons which they have had no direct opportunity to address. I respect very much Ms. Eubank's expertise in the tobacco litigation which she's addressed. I do have a couple of questions about that litigation to address. I think this board would do well, before it takes final action, if it seeks to inform itself on what academic freedom means, to invite some comments of those who might have a different view and who might not agree that they are fools and knaves to think that academic freedom has some bearing on this issue. You have a list before you of a list of recipients of current research money associated with the tobacco industry. And I would venture that virtually every PI on that list would greatly treasure the ability to speak to you, as Ms. Eubanks has been given the ability to speak to you, and might have a different perspective to offer about why they conduct the research and why they have accepted funds from their research funding sources. As to the litigation in the District of Columbia and Judge Kessler's order, I congratulate Ms. Eubanks on a splendid job of litigating the judgment, an extremely difficult case. have a couple of questions. The first is whether or not I am correct in my assumption, based on some knowledge of complex federal civil litigation, that Judge Kessler's extraordinary opinion, 1,700 pages in length, with 4,088 separately stated findings of fact and conclusions of law, whether I'm true in simply guessing that that closely followed the proposed findings of facts and conclusions of law that you, as a successful attorney, submitted to the court.
Remarkably, not quite so much. We submitted 2,500 pages of proposed findings of fact, and I think another over 1,000 pages of conclusions of law. The judge did not find, with respect to the United States, in a manner consistent with everything that we said. Indeed, her writing, and if the lawyers in the room certainly know this, oftentimes the judge will, if they're going your way, merely adopt what it is you said. She provided analysis and went a step further.
Could you rehearse for this group those findings of fact in Judge Kessler's opinion that implicated any way the activities of the University of California?
It's laid out in the opinion, and if you give me a moment, I have a notebook back at my feet if you really want me to tell you some of the specifics.
I just a thumbnail sketch because we've heard a great deal about somehow UC's involvement, I have studied it closely, and it seems that out of those 4,088 findings of fact, there is one, 3781, that says that a researcher associated with UC published a peer-reviewed survey of the effects of environmental tobacco smoke, and then continues on from findings 3782 to 3789 to recite ties between that researcher and the tobacco industry. And then in the concluding findings of 3790 to 3792 says that despite controversy about this peer-reviewed journal piece, the tobacco industry used it to advance their own interests. And that's all I could find about the University of California in that opinion.
Well, as with any opinion, you need to read it entirely in its context. When the judge took on the issue of the research findings and the, as we called it, at the pillar in our case, the myth of independent research, she set that up by going through about the lawyers' involvement and how researchers were paid more money as their findings were going to a particular area of interest to them that they could use in the court process. So I think it would be improper to read the decision simply by carving out some of the paragraphs that refer specifically to the University of California and to look at it more broadly, because pretty soon the University of California, if it doesn't have a policy, will be one of the few prominent universities in a position to accept this funding. And I mean, I hear what you're saying about academic freedom, even though I disagree with your assessment of how we could be practiced here, because when Mr. Dines was saying a moment ago that the use of the research could be something that could be determined, I don't know how a year later, after the research is done, it's being used improperly in a court of law where you're not even connected with that necessarily, that the university would have any standing to raise any concerns. I don't understand how it is that you could ignore the other factual findings within the section of the court's opinion on the myth of independent research, reading it all together as a whole in what the judge found. She did not single out any particular university. There were issues surrounding a researcher at Harvard. She did not necessarily do that, and that's not what I'm here to tell you, that the University of California has been bad here. That's not what I'm saying.
Well, let me just clarify. You're very familiar with this litigation. Is there any finding that a researcher associated with the University of California violated standards of research integrity as opposed to published a study with which others disagree, and on one side of which of that disagreement, the tobacco industry has aligned itself in its usual venal self-interest.
Well, I was born at night, but not last night. Before I would answer such a question, I would want to look at the university's policy that you speak of to make a determination objectively as to whether I believe that there was a violation by what it is that the court found that that
I'm sorry, I asked if the judge made such a finding.
If the judge did not have before her as evidence any of the policies and practices requiring researchers to act in a certain way who research for the University of California. So I can assure you, without even re-looking at the opinion, that she did not make that finding overtly.
Yeah, I would like to see if I can move this back.
Okay, I have one more. Can I have one more question?
It's a very quick one. Sure. All right. You mentioned it couldn't get any better than having a focused opinion of a district judge. Of course, it might get better if it had been affirmed on appeal. I wondered if you could tell me the significance of an order that I frankly was surprised not to read about in any of the materials supplied in connection with this presentation. I just found it on the web trying to find the judge's opinion, but it is an order by the District of Columbia Circuit Court of Appeal on October 31, 2006, by a 2-1 vote that states that they are going to grant an emergency stay of the judge's injunctive relief. Quote, appellants have satisfied the stringent standards required for a stay pending appeal, citing various case law which says, among other things, that includes consideration of the likelihood of prevailing on appeal.
If there's a question there somewhere, I think
we violated the if it's brief. I would appreciate if you would be extremely brief. We need to close this item. I know you have a plan and an idea to do that. I would appreciate the support of the regents here in bringing that to closure.
If
you want to give me a very brief answer and then...
That was not a decision on the merits. That was an interlocutory order. The case will be briefed in December of this year. It will go up. Cert has already been denied by the Supreme Court on a question of whether the case was right. So yes, and still, there is a petition for Supreme Court review. That just deferred the decision or the action of the remedy until such time as the Court of Appeals could act.
Thank you. We have two other regents who requested to speak. I would like to bring some closure to this, and I have a suggestion on how to do that. And so what I'm going to do is offer that, and then I'm going to open it up. If the regents still want to provide comment, I would appreciate that. But it strikes me that on the item before us, which is RE89 and the proposal, there is not a consensus to move forward. There has been an offer from the president and I think from Regent Blum and from the faculty and the provost to work on this issue and to bring it back to us. It strikes me that that would be a valuable thing to do. We've talked about our interest in maintaining some oversight, but that's not the proposal before us. And until that issue is right, it strikes me that our discussion here would not be fruitful. And so I'm going to suggest that we table this item, bring it back in September, with hopefully there will be some conclusion as to a compromise on how we might approach this issue going forward. Now, that's my suggestion. Regent, you're fine. Regent, no opinion. If you want to make a comment, okay, very good. That's my suggestion. Regent Morris.
Since this is my issue, I think that's entirely appropriate. I think we can probably get something worked out. But I do have one burning question. Is there any history in recent years, Rory, I know you haven't been here in perpetuity. I know you had a lot before the University of California. Is there any history of the university ever declining tobacco funds from any of these front organizations?
I don't know. Of course,
I think that's a hard question. There's a lot of theoretical discussion here about the fact that you have academic freedom, and this is supposed to be a self-regulating system. So before the IM comes up in September...
Let me make it more global. I don't know specifically on tobacco, but there is a history of the University of California declining research funds. We can find the answer to your question.
I would specifically like to know from the there's a panoply of tobacco organizations withdrawn because of court order, and they were reluctantly disposed of. But I'd like to, with some specificity, on the narrow issue of tobacco, nicotine, that sort of thing.
All right. I think that's a fine suggestion. That would be part of our material to suggest our input for the September discussion.
Great.
With concurrence, we'll put that table that motion.
Great. Thank you all.
Thank you.